Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. We're going to have a very interesting discussion today, and we're kind of reaching a little far out of Atlanta. My guest today is Dr. Joseph Pinzone, and he is going to be joining us from Los Angeles, California. Welcome, Dr. Pinzone.
Thank you, Tanya, very much for having me.
Very good. And I want to talk a little bit about this topic today because there's a lot in the news, always almost any headline, about hormones. From hormone replacement therapy to insulin resistance in the pancreas to sex hormones. We just see hormones in practically every media we look at. And the pituitary gland is often referred to as the master gland of the body. And we've gone out and tried to get you one of the masters of this topic today. And the topic is diseases of the pituitary gland, and that is Dr. Pinzone. And let me tell you a little bit about him. First off, he got his medical training at NYU in New York City and went on to get his internal medicine residency training at Columbia Presbyterian. But that wasn't enough for him. He went on to train with Mass General in endocrinology. He also has his MBA from George Washington University, so he is double board certified. He does clinical practice and also is involved in academics and research. He was a former NIH-funded researcher in the area of pituitary tumors, and he's been on the clinical faculty at George Washington and Ohio State, and he is currently the assistant clinical professor at UCLA. But I think his passion at the moment is private practice in Santa Monica, California. So welcome, Dr. Pinzone, and why don't you tell us a little bit about your current practice?
Right. Well, thank you for that very kind introduction, Tanya. That was very comprehensive, and it is true, you know, through the years, my passion is really directly taking care of patients, and I'd be delighted to tell you about the practice that I've currently created. It's novel in many ways. It is a private practice, and I function as both an internist and an endocrinologist. As you mentioned, I'm double boarded. However, I also realize that the vast majority of my patients need someone else to help me care for them. And so I conceived of four fundamental areas of medicine, nutrition, fitness, and psychology. And so consequently, I have on my staff a dietitian, personal trainers, and psychologists who function mostly as life coaches. And we created this practice with the idea that folks could engage us in any way that's right for them. So the majority of people engage us one at a time. So for example, they'll come in and I'll just be their doctor and they won't see anybody else. Or they might see Shaney, my dietitian. On the other hand, some people need and value that team approach, and we really are able to synergize in those instances to be able to look 360 degrees at their health. So that's a little bit about my current practice.
And
a novel model, and we're finding great success and great satisfaction.
Right, so you kind of blend concierge medicine together with traditional disease management in a very personalized way across these fitness, nutrition, psychology, and traditional medicine platforms. I was interested when we were speaking on the phone in preparation for today about the name of your practice. So if you could just tell us the name and that story.
Yes, you know, it's. I'm so glad you asked, actually, because I really enjoy this story. I was in college, and I was in a developmental psychology class. And my practice is called AMAI, A-M-A-I. Now, that word is a Japanese word, and in fact, in the context of that class, it was introduced as the concept of the Japanese version of unconditional love. Now, I have since found out that, and I've always carried with me and sort of remembered that word and just thought it was, for lack of a better word, just a cool word. but it, you know, also obviously carried a meaning. I've since found out that it literally means sweet when describing food. And so we've really translated into sort of the ultimate in care. in the context of the way we use it in our practice.
So we know that you care about us, and you've got lots of different ways to connect all the dots when you're taking care of us. Now, I want to jump into an area where you've spent a good part of your career, and that is in dealing with diseases of the pituitary gland. So why don't you start with the audience just explaining a little bit about the anatomy of it and its function as the master gland?
That's a great place to start. Let me preempt that with just one or two quick things. First, I remember from our preparation when you and I were speaking, that we have a mixture of doctors and patients listening.
Correct.
And pituitary diseases is an area, all areas of medicine are sort of complex, and some, however, are a little bit better known by the public. This is an area that is often not as well known by doctors or patients, for that matter, unless you specialize in it. And so I'd like to make two points about that. One of them is, it's unless you do a gloss over, which I don't plan on doing, you do have to address some of the complexity of it, number one. And number two, I will use some jargon, but I'll also try to define that jargon. And so even though we're covering a lot of ground here because diseases of the pituitary are quite varied, if you know a few core things, and I'll summarize them at the end, you'll know most of pituitary disease in terms of how it happens in practice. The other point I wanted to make is that typically it's really important to have an endocrinologist involved in addition to an internist. Again, I say typically because we never say always in medicine. But with that, let me talk a little bit about why the pituitary gland is called the master gland. Our body communicates, everything sort of starts in the brain, right? The brain directs what we do and how our body functions, and that probably doesn't come as a surprise to people. So there's really only two ways to communicate to the rest of the body, either through the nerves, and they actually end in chemicals, right, in neurotransmitters, or through hormones. And that really happens through the pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland, though technically not part of the brain, sits right below it. And it's controlled. Signals from different parts of the brain go to the hypothalamus, which is at the base of the brain, and send hormones down to the pituitary, which then sends out hormones into the bloodstream. And we'll talk about that more in depth in a minute. The pituitary, in terms of its size, is about the size of a pea. So about 8 millimeters to a centimeter long, less than half an inch. It weighs about 500 to 600 milligrams, maybe twice the weight of a pea, because it's made up of human tissue. So it's quite small, but very powerful, and really a watershed for a lot of the functioning of our body. If you were to locate the pituitary, you would put one finger right between your eyes and another finger right on the side of your head, right in the middle of the side of your head. And if you bisected those lines, that's right about where the pituitary gland would be.
It's right in the middle.
And right in the middle. Right in the middle. And so that leads us to a couple of key things about the pituitary anatomy. One of them is it's in a very small space, and it's surrounded by very critical structures. On top is what we call the optic chiasm. That's where our optic tracts from the brain, part of them cross over and become the optic nerves that supply our vision. So obviously as a pituitary tumor grows, if it grows up, it can affect our vision. Below it is something called the sphenoid sinus. And a sinus is just an area where there's a mucus-lined cavity. It helps to decompress our skull when we change altitude. It's for all different reasons. We have, as you know, sinuses, and that's one of them. On either side of the pituitary gland is something called the cavernous sinus. And in there is the internal carotid artery, a main artery that supplies the brain, as well as cranial nerves that control eye movements and facial sensation. And so as best we can, without rendering a picture for our audience, that really describes the anatomy of the pituitary gland.
Okay, let's move along and talk about what all it does. So the function, it touches many different body systems, organ systems. So let's talk a little bit about the physiology side.
That's exactly the next place that that my mind goes when I think about the pituitary gland. And let's start with running through the hormones that it secretes. It secretes six hormones, and I'm going to run through them. Again, it's tough if you don't have this as your base to really talk about pituitary diseases. So for the patients out there, they may want to be taking notes if they're interested or think they might have a problem. One of them is prolactin, and prolactin is responsible for milk, what we call milk letdown or breastfeeding. That's essentially having the milk come out of the breast. Then there's growth hormone, which in children is responsible for linear growth, and in adults it's responsible for body composition and sort of general well-being. Then there's LH and FSH. They are the gonadotropins, meaning the sex hormones. They control reproduction in women, and they control reproduction in men, okay? And then there's TSH, thyroid-stimulating hormone, that controls secretion of the thyroid hormone from the thyroid gland. Again, remember, the pituitary hormones are traveling throughout the body and then acting at the end organ to cause that end organ to secrete those hormones. And finally, ACTH, adrenocorticotropin hormone, induces the adrenal gland to secrete cortisol, which is extremely important for salt and water balance and very important for survival. So that's the function of the pituitary gland. So when we think about our hormonal balance, the way to think about it is that except for prolactin, and I'll get to that in a second, what people mean by hormone balance, particularly when they're referring to pituitary-derived hormones, is the fact that for any of those hormones, let's take growth hormone, for example. Growth hormone is secreted. It induces the liver to produce IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1. IGF-1 goes out and does what it does to cells. It affects metabolism. It affects fat mass. It affects muscles. It also travels back to the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland and says, hey guys, there's enough of me around. And so it functions as a negative feedback loop. And again, the only, and that's true of TSH, the thyroid hormone feeds back, et cetera. I won't go through them all. I will say that the one exception is that prolactin is under inhibitory control. So dopamine inhibits prolactin secretion. So as a woman is pregnant, the pituitary grows and the prolactin cells grow and the prolactin goes up, allowing her to breastfeed. So that's, and there's no sort of feedback mechanism to that. So that's just one exception.
Okay, very good. So we have a whole cascade, hormone cascade, that starts in the pituitary gland, links to each organ for each one of these hormones, and affects everything from our water balance to milk production to how we metabolize. Kind of, there's no part of the body, almost, it seems, that is not affected in some
That's
way.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And so this little pea-sized thing affects our a lot.
Affects a lot. And yeah. And a lot of these hormones will act together on the same tissues. So, for example, thyroid hormone acts on the heart along with IGF-1. And so we're finding that there's a lot of sort of cross-coverage and cross-control that a lot of these hormones have. And again, it's a little beyond the scope of what we need to discuss today.
Yeah, well, let's move on and talk a little bit about, on the scope of, like, compared to heart disease or cancer, we don't hear a lot about pituitary issues, so it may not be one of our top problems that we face with in healthcare. However, if you have that problem, it's going to be affecting a lot. So can you speak a little bit to the incidence and prevalence of pituitary disorders, both here in our country and worldwide?
Well, it's interesting because you have said it really exactly right. Fortunately, pituitary disease doesn't result in a lot of people dying. It can, of course, become quite serious, and people can die. But just to give you a sense of the incidence and prevalence of pituitary disease, it's a very difficult question to answer because on the one end, it's interesting, let's take two examples, two extreme examples of the many conditions that you can have in the pituitary gland. The most common one is a pituitary tumor. Now, it would surprise people to know that approximately one in every 10 people have a pituitary tumor.
Now, that doesn't sound too rare.
So the chance of knowing somebody, as long as you know more than 10 people, it's pretty good that you know somebody with a pituitary tumor. The difference, of course, is that the number of people that actually that tumor causes problems in is relatively small, fortunately. The reason we know the 1 in 10 number is because ever since we've had the advent of CT scans and now the even more fine detail of MRI scans, they're found incidentally. And so we know, wow, they're pretty darn common, and that person never would have known they've had it. Contrast that with something like a deficiency in a factor, in a genetic factor that is involved in the development of pituitary cells. We'll just pick one of those factors. It's called PIT1, and it's a particular type of protein that allows the development of cells that secrete growth hormone, prolactin, and TSH. So if you have a mutation in PIT1, you then have decreases in those three hormones. I looked long and hard. It's so rare, we can't even really get numbers. So we're thinking maybe a couple people in a million, maybe less than one in a million. Again, it's hard to say because it's so rare. So it really spans the spectrum, and I think it doesn't get a lot of attention because, again, fortunately not a lot of people die of it. That said, we have good numbers in the United States. Worldwide, it's even harder to get those numbers because we really have sort of one of the most advanced healthcare systems and do some of the most testing and research and all that.
Very good. So let's talk about, we know it's common, 1 in 10. A lot of people don't have symptoms, so they won't even know they have it. But let's talk a little bit about what are some of the diseases. You said number one thing that you're going to find as far as an abnormality in this gland is tumors, pituitary tumors. What would be some examples of other diseases associated with the pituitary gland?
Great. Well, here again, I think it's really worthwhile to consider the aspects of the pituitary gland just the way you set them up, which is to first think of its structure and then to think of its function. And so the categories of diseases include neoplastic, which means new growth. And within that, let me talk briefly about that because it is so common and it will be the topic that we discuss for much of our talk, is a pituitary adenoma. Now, that's not cancer. Doesn't mean if it grows big, it can't cause problems. It can push on all those structures. And there are, of course, a variety of other types of tumors. I won't get into all of them. You could even have metastasis from a breast or a lung or a colon cancer that gets into the pituitary gland. But again, much less common than a pituitary adenoma, which is the most common. Pituitary cancer can happen, extremely rare. Let me go through some of the other things that can cause pituitary issues. Now, with the neoplastic diseases, it depends on the tumor. It can cause low pituitary function or over-secretion of hormones. In almost all of the other diseases, your biggest risk is low pituitary function because there's something that's just adversely affecting the pituitary that doesn't have to do with the pituitary cells themselves. So that includes trauma, right? So if you have surgery for a pituitary tumor, you could be left with low pituitary, or radiation, or an increasing realization of head injury. The third category would be structural. So you could either have, again, normal or low pituitary function. And that's another thing that's commonly seen on an MRI scan, is something called empty cella syndrome, because you've got a defect in the lining of the skull, and it causes abnormal pressure, and it sort of smushes the pituitary. So a structural disease is number three. Number four is an infiltrative or inflammatory disease. So you can get an autoimmune process or an abnormal protein, as in hemochromatosis, that goes in iron an abnormal chemical, rather, iron that goes in. So you have that category of disease. You have vascular disease. So, and I'll mention two things in particular under vascular. One of them is pituitary apoplexy that happens because the blood supply of a tumor as it grows never quite has the integrity of a normal gland. And so if there's a big bleed, you can very quickly become hypopituitary, have low hormones, and that's a pituitary emergency. And the other context that can happen is with lots of bleeding from pregnancy, where you can have that vascular accident in your pituitary gland. The sixth is infections, fungal, tuberculosis, and a variety of others. And the last, and probably the least common, is developmental, and that we talked about briefly. You can have genetic problems with the development of the pituitary gland.
Okay, very good. Well, I'd like to kind of go circle back around and talk about pituitary tumors specifically, since that's the most common thing that we're going to see. And you mentioned most of these are benign adenomas. So why don't we kind of just dive in a little deeper about these particular tumors? What are the symptoms? How do they affect the surrounding structures? That kind of thing.
Great. Let's talk about that. So we need to know two simple terms. There are microadenomas and macroadenomas. And the dividing line is the 1 centimeter line. If you're below 1 centimeter, you've got a microadenoma. If you're a centimeter or above in any dimension, you've got a macroadenoma. Now, any of the tumor types that I'm going to talk about can be in either a microadenoma or a macroadenoma. The first type, there's two most common types. One of them is non-functioning, meaning it doesn't produce hormones or it doesn't produce active hormones. And those, as you might imagine, are discovered one of two ways, either incidentally on the scan, as we talked about, and they can often be microadenomas, and they're usually not of grave concern, but again, it's good to get an expert opinion about those. But often enough, you know, if you don't have a reason to get an MRI of your head, you won't know about it, and you won't have any other symptoms from hormones, and so they can grow quite large and cause things like blindness if they grow up. They can even cause things like stroke if they grow to the side, or nerve problems, because growth is the main issue there.
Do they grow at different rates, Dr. Pinzo? Like, do micro or macro grow at different speeds?
You know, that's an excellent question, and that's something where we do have some good data. And the answer is, like all tumors, the cause of the tumor is a mutation. And we know that the incidentally discovered microadenomas, most of them actually don't grow, fortunately. But a select group, and we're just now starting to understand which genes are turned on, makes those tumors grow even faster. A subset do grow faster. And that subset, that's why I said lots of people have the tumors. It's only a smaller subset who suffer the consequences of them. And that's either because they grow too large as the non-functioning ones, or because they oversecrete a hormone, as we're about to talk about.
Okay, very good. So let's talk a little bit about some of those hormones that over or underproduce then, and the results of that.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Yep, let's do that. So I'll run through them, and we'll now look at the abnormal side of what they do. So prolactin is also a very common tumor. And that tumor can be picked up either as a micro or a macroadenoma. The context where you pick it up as a microadenoma is in premenopausal women, so that is women of childbearing years. Why? Because if prolactin goes up, the period shut off. So prolactin, not only does prolactin affect the breast, and so you can get breast enlargement, mostly in men, although some in women, you can get breast discharge, mostly in women, you also shut down the reproductive axis. Now, you might think, why? Well, because your body doesn't think, geez, I've got a tumor producing prolactin. It says, I'm about to breastfeed. Probably not a good time to get pregnant again just yet. So there's, in essence, a compensatory reaction where even if you have a little bit of prolactin go up, okay, in a microadenoma, and the amount of hormone oversecretion usually correlates with the size of the tumor, you immediately get a shutdown of the reproductive axis, and that's easy to pick up because a woman misses her periods.
Mm-hmm.
In postmenopausal women or in men, that's a much harder thing to pick up, and they're more often macroadenomas, the larger kind of tumors in those folks. And again, they can get all of the problems that I said, breast discharge and breast growth and breast pain.
What about an excess of growth hormone, like a tumor that causes an excess of growth hormone? What happens?
Right. So now we're getting into the less common tumor types.
Okay.
And tumors that secrete growth hormone, it's very interesting the way things happen in the pituitary gland. You know, people are used to tumors. People are used to talking about cancer when they talk about tumors. And most cancers, not all, most grow pretty quickly. But as we've talked about, most of the tumors, though they can get big, grow over the course of months, more likely years. And so when a tumor, the particular cells that produce growth hormone are the ones that are mutated, and they grow into an adenoma, that's called acromegaly. Well, it's interesting. They're typically picked up as macroadenomas. Why? Because the changes that happen in adults usually happen over the course of a decade plus. So they include increases in bone size and increases in organ size. And the organ size includes facial features, which can coarsen. In children, for example, before their bone growth, before their pussies close, they can actually get what's called gigantism. So they may or may not get sort of the abnormal features. They may just grow really tall. So when you see somebody over 7 feet, you think to yourself, huh, I wonder if they have a tumor that's overproducing growth hormone. Most of them don't, but, you know, in the NBA, it's not unheard of.
That's interesting. So you look at all the basketball players and think, I wonder if you know what you have.
That's exactly yeah. right. And, you know, it's funny.
That's normal. If it's normal or abnormal, right?
That's right. That's right.
Very good. Okay, and let's talk about underproduction. Some of these tumors that go the other way instead of overproduction, underproduction, and the results of what we might see there.
Sure, let's do that. Before we do that, let me just briefly mention one other one that's quite important, something called Cushing syndrome, where ACTH is overproduced and causes too much cortisol. That is analogous to your body having, you know, people are familiar with things like prednisone, same class of molecule, a glucocorticoid. So you can get some very serious problems from that, including hypertension, diabetes, big truncal obesity around your middle, very thin arms, big purple stria on your belly. I mention that for completeness. The other types of oversecretion are much less common. But let me go ahead and move on to your next question about undersecretion. So what happens when you get an undersecretion of hormones is, of course, it completely depends upon what's being undersecreted, mm-hmm. right? So the prolactin is one where the only time you're really going to feel low prolactin is if you're a woman who happens to have low prolactin for one reason or another. Usually you've had another pituitary tumor, and then you want to go to breastfeed, and you really can't. So that's really where that comes into play. And then you just it's easy to check. You just check it with prolactin, okay? If you have low growth hormone, okay, and you're a child, you can get short stature, a high-pitched voice, predisposition to hypoglycemia because you have unopposed insulin action. If you're an adult and you have low growth hormone, you can get impaired quality of life. Now, I know that seems vague, and in fact, it is vague, and that's why it's so difficult to pin it down. But you can get decreased energy and drive, poor concentration. You can get body composition changes, increased heart disease, and osteoporosis. And you check that by trying to stimulate growth hormone, okay, and measuring IGF-1, and you treat it by replacing growth hormone. And for FSH and LH, of course, what we talked about is the syndrome of hypogonadism. And in children, that's a failure to go through puberty. In women, their menses stop. And in men, they get low testosterone and they stop producing sperm. And you can treat that either with oral contraceptives for women or testosterone for men. Interestingly, if it happens in a younger person and they want to get pregnant, you actually have to give them pulsatile injections of hormones that act like LH and FSH. And so those are those hormones.
So kind of supplementing.
The last two I'll mention is TSH gives you low thyroid, and so you can get low energy and all of the things that go with low thyroid. And then ACTH, when it's low, the cortisol goes low, and again, that can be life-threatening in its worst form.
Then how is that life-threatening? What happens?
Well, it's very important that we have cortisol. It affects so many body systems. It affects the heart, it affects the blood pressure, and it affects the salt and water balance. So because you're losing salt, you're losing water, and your blood pressure is dropping, you're losing cognitive function, and it's just one of those hormones that's essential for life. And because the symptoms are often so vague, you can get cognitive problems, you just don't feel right, and it can happen very quickly, particularly with those bleeds in the pituitary that we talked about. It's really important to recognize that early.
Right. So we talked about a lot of people walk around and maybe have a pituitary problem but don't know. You mentioned that the symptoms are very vague, depending upon what end organ might be involved or structurally what's being infringed on up in the brain. So tell us a little bit about the symptoms and how you diagnose pituitary issues.
Okay, well, that's an excellent question. So let's think a little bit about the tumors and how they're diagnosed if they overproduce. We talked about what happens with growth hormones. Your bones can grow and your soft tissues can grow. Interestingly, in acromegaly, and in Cushing's disease, you often don't have to have a super high level of growth hormone or ACTH. It's the end organ that is, in fact, high. And so the way we diagnose those is by trying to suppress cortisol with another hormone. And if we can suppress it, great. That rules out Cushing's. There's other problems that are causing your obesity and the other problems that you're having. For growth hormone, you give sugar and you try, it's a simple sugar test where you're drinking glucose, and you try to suppress growth hormone. And if you can suppress it, great. And if your IGF-1, there you can measure IGF-1 is in the normal range, great, you don't have it. If not, then you go on to imaging. So imaging is always a confirmatory test in these situations of overproduction. Prolactin is an easier one because it's just easy to measure prolactin. But again, you're always combining that with imaging. And the best imaging to get of a pituitary gland is an MRI with and without gadolinium. That means with and without contrast dye. So that's how you would diagnose the overproduction of the hormones.
Okay.
The underproduction of the hormones are another story altogether. You can check the prolactin. Again, that's an easy one to check, although it's typically not relevant to have low prolactin. The growth hormone, you check it by trying to stimulate growth hormone secretion, and again, by measuring IGF-1. And that's how you'd check for low growth hormone, and you'd treat it by just simply giving injections of growth hormone. For people who have, again, low LH and FSH, you would check both LH and FSH as well as the end organ sex hormones, testosterone and estrogen in a woman, although not as helpful. And you'd get both low LH and FSH and the end organ would be low as well. Similarly for TSH, you would just check both TSH and free T4, which is a measure of thyroid hormone. Both would be low, and that would tell you, aha, there's probably a problem with TSH production, because normally, if there were a thyroid problem, the TSH would be very high. It would say, hey, I'm not seeing any thyroid hormone. There's no negative feedback. So again, it comes full circle to understanding those negative feedback loops and how they work to be able to properly diagnose, do you have an oversecretion or an undersecretion of a particular hormone?
So it sounds like the pathway is the patient has a symptom. We try to figure out why. There's some simple blood tests sometimes, oftentimes, that can be done. You'll stress the system and see over or under production, where are we, and then confirm with MRI.
That's exactly okay. The way it goes.
Okay.
You have encapsulated it well. Hopefully I've described it well, but that's pretty much it. They're mostly picked up by symptoms. Again, sometimes things are picked up incidentally, but it's mostly a patient coming and saying, hey, you know, I just don't feel right. Mm-hmm. For example, ophthalmologists and optometrists often pick up the vision changes that can occur, right? Mm-hmm. Dentists will often pick up acromegaly because in addition to the bones growing, one of the bones is the mandible, the jaw. And when that happens, the teeth get spaced, widely spaced. So often you'll get a referral, an endocrinologist will get a referral from a dentist saying, hey, I think this person has acromegaly. So you really, it's
you start at the end.
You have to really
you start
vigilant.
At the end. Yeah, you start at the end and work all the way back.
That's
so,
right.
Very good. So once we identify there's a problem, we have our confirmatory image. You've mentioned along the way some types of treatments are simple, like, for example, taking thyroid medication once you know that you're underproducing or something like that. But in the actual pituitary tumors, what would the treatment, like, are they able to be surgically removed? Is radiation a consideration? What's kind of the thought process of the actual pituitary tumor itself?
Right. So here's another example of where in pretty much every case, it's good to have a specialist involved because they're typically very, very tricky decisions that have to be made very artfully, integrating lots of information. For prolactinomas, for tumors that oversecrete prolactin, whether they are microadenomas or macroadenomas, almost all of them, not all of them, some of them need surgery, but almost all of them can be treated with medication because we have these very powerful medications called cavergoline and bromocriptine that are dopamine agonists. And again, translation of the word agonist for the patient is it acts like dopamine. And so it can actually not only suppress prolactin, it can cause a decrease in tumor size and in some cases completely cure the patient and get rid of the tumor just by taking medication once or twice a week in the case of cavergoline.
Which is kind of foreign when we think about the word tumor, but again, we're mostly not talking about metastatic disease.
That's
we're
right.
Talking
and,
about
and you hit on it. That's the difference. They don't spread throughout the body typically. They're typically not cancer. They're typically adenomas and stay in one place and cause all their problems there. Now, for all the other tumor types, surgery has a role. Now, if you pick up incidentally a tumor that's non-functioning, you've sort of checked it for the function and you say, hey, you know, this is just an incidentally found microadenoma. For those tumors, you can typically just follow them and get a follow-up MRI, let's say in 3 months and then at a year or something like that. And if that's not growing, then just as well leave it alone because obviously surgery can have its own complications.
So are there tumors that just kind of sit in there and really don't do a whole lot over time?
Those are most of the tumors, believe it or not.
All right.
They're most of the tumors, as we've said, so you're exactly right. In contrast, though, once you've got a tumor that's showing you that it's going to do some stuff, like oversecrete growth hormone or oversecrete ACTH, or it's a non-functioning tumor that's a macroadenoma, you pretty much need surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much the standard first line. First thing you do is surgery. Most surgeries, although not all, can be accomplished, believe it or not, endoscopically through the nose. So what happens is a neurosurgeon works often alone if they're an expert, and I would highly, highly recommend that if you're contemplating, if you need pituitary surgery, that you get to somebody who does a lot of pituitary surgery. It's very, very specialized, very delicate. They actually are able to, either themselves or along with an ear, nose, and throat doctor, you know, tap a little hole, for lack of a better word, into your sphenoid sinus, then tap a little hole into the sella turcica. It's Latin for Turkish saddle, which is the place where the pituitary lives, and get at the pituitary that way. That's very convenient, and that helps because that cuts down on the morbidity or the problems that the patient has. Some tumors, like I said, grow so large that you're never going to get them all out that way, and that's where that expert judgment call comes. And in that case, those patients may need transcranial surgery, meaning that they need traditional brain surgery where you've got to cut a piece of the skull off, you've got to retract part of the brain, and you've got to get at it that way. And that, of course, is a much more serious situation.
Yeah, and for the audience, mostly we're talking about surgery in a space, like you said, if the gland is like a pea or a lima bean, that's less than an inch inside of your head.
That's right.
Yep, so hence the delicacy in getting the access to it.
That's right.
Okay, so that's after right. surgical intervention.
So, excellent question. So, one of two things happens. Either you're cured or you're not. And it depends on the tumor type. You can tell for non-functioning tumors based upon the MRI scan. You can tell for things like Cushing's disease and acromegaly based on hormone tests, right? Are the hormones now normalized? In some cases, they will be. And in cases where you can't quite find the tumor, and believe it or not, some of them are so small but so problematic you can't find them. The surgeon can't find them, and they did their best during surgery, but they just couldn't get it. Or they're so large they couldn't get it all. That's where the adjunctive therapies come in. So a number of patients need either radiation or medication. So let me go through that a bit. There's three types of radiation. There's radiation that you traditionally sort of get radiation to the side of your head in multiple treatments. But there's a newer advance that I would recommend in pretty much all cases, or most cases, which is the gamma knife. And what that does is that puts a helmet on your head and shines a lower strength photon radiation beam through the little holes in the helmet. And the holes are all pointed so that where they cross, and this is all done with imaging, right? Very sophisticated, mm-hmm. stereotactic surgery.
A lot of measuring to get in the right spot.
Right on that tumor.
Right.
That's right. That's right. It focuses the beam right on that tumor. And so, consequently, the bulk of the brain gets a lot less radiation because it's where the beams cross that is the bulk of the radiation is delivered. So, again, very important to get to the right center to do that. And then the final type of radiation is called proton beam, and that not all centers have, again, a little beyond the scope of what we do here. But there's some very interesting medications we can use, and we can maybe spend just a few minutes talking about those, mm-hmm. Beyond the ones for prolactin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
So for acromegaly, we actually have two types of treatments. One of them is a class of medication. Again, this is going to be a technical term that I throw out there that you'd only want to know about if you have the disease or knew somebody with the disease. They're called somatostatin analogs. And very much like dopamine agonists that do for prolactinomas, they actually attack the tumor itself. Now, they're not as powerful and they're not as surefire as the dopamine agonists. And so they work. But often you need something beyond that. And so we have another medicine called pegvisomant that actually blocks the growth hormone receptor. Okay? And so it causes a prevention of growth hormone secretion on that basis. And a prevention of growth hormone action on that basis. Okay, so it prevents the production of IGF-1 because it blocks the growth hormone. So it doesn't do anything for the tumor, but it certainly does something for the acromegaly. And you can often combine those with the somatostatin analogs. So that's a very important thing to consider. For the Cushing syndrome, where you get too much cortisol, there are particular medications that will cause the adrenal glands to secrete less cortisol. If that doesn't work, as again, they're not quite as powerful, not quite as sure-footed as dopamine agonists are for prolactinomas, you can then either remove the whole pituitary gland, which sometimes even doesn't work, believe it or not, or you can remove the adrenal glands themselves. So you may have some more drastic measures with acromegaly and Cushing's than with some of the other tumors in terms of the medications that are used. So the reason why you would use medication versus radiation, sometimes you use both. Again, medications act fairly immediately. They begin acting. Radiation often takes months to years to really begin to see an effect. And why is that? Well, the way radiation works is it damages DNA. And you'd say to yourself, geez, isn't that the thing that caused the tumor? Well, sure, but in this case, you're trying to damage the DNA of the tumor. And if you damage it enough, the tumor cells die. The problem, of course, is that those tumor cells only die when they go to replicate. And even compared to other cancers, they replicate very slowly. And so the effect of radiation often takes quite some time to show up in terms of a smaller tumor or lower hormone production. And again, I know that's a lot to digest, but I wanted to make sure I got to that because those are the complexities of how to deal with those rare but very problematic tumors.
One question I had on the medication intervention is, I know we hear tumors and we think blood-brain barrier and how much it really gets through the vasculature. Is that a consideration with pituitary tumors and the medicine?
Well, that's an excellent question. Because it really is outside of the brain, mm-hmm. we usually get pretty good vascular access to the pituitary with those medications. So that's usually not a big barrier to treatment. The barrier is finding the medications that are, for lack of
effective.
A better word, strong enough to
right.
deal with
effective
the
enough.
Particular tumor.
Very good. Well, we certainly have had a good primer on the different types of tumors and surgical and radiation and medication intervention. I'd like you to, we're going to run out of time here in a few minutes, but I do want to spend just a few minutes because I know you're so active in the field and you've spent quite a bit of your time researching. What is kind of coming up with these diseases? Is there anything new on the horizon or has it been kind of business as usual in this field?
You know, it's interesting. It's a great question. And one of the reasons I went into endocrinology is because I felt like there would be so many advances over my career compared to many other fields. Of course, there's advances in many fields, oncology, et cetera. But we really do have tremendous advances in endocrinology, and pituitary is no exception. Two things I'd like to talk about. One of them is intraoperative MRI scans. And again, this is one of those situations where it's really critical to get in front of the right person, but there are facilities where they have very high-resolution MRI scanners. And so because in the case of pituitary adenomas, they often don't look very different from the normal tissue, it is tougher than one might think to say, that's tumor, that's not. So intraoperative MRI helps to get around that in some cases by the surgeon aiming for whatever they think they can do, either a cure or to debulk most of it, whatever's reasonable. Getting the MRI during the surgery and saying, ah, there's some more. I'm going to go ahead and go after it, or there's some more. I can't get it, but it gives you that information. So that's one advance.
So it's kind of like real-time high-resonance imaging during surgery.
That's right.
Okay.
That's exactly right, and it's available at select centers. And I'm going to give people some resources in a minute of how to get to select centers, by the way. And then, you know, the second thing I'd like to talk about is genetics. The way we're expanding our repertoire of how to treat these tumors is because, as you know, at the turn of the century, around about, we had the first cloning of the full human genome. So advances in genetics are what are really going to lead to the ability to have more targeted therapy, to better understand the genetic problems of the tumors themselves, and then to know how to go about treating them. And eventually, I believe, whether it's pituitary disease or cancer, we'll be able to prevent them. Again, I'm not going to give a timeline on that, but it's those genetic advances that are really pushing the field ahead.
That's exciting for sure. Let's talk about, before we close, I know a lot of the audience remembers patient success stories as opposed to just statistics or the technical side of things. Have there been any patients in your career that really come to mind in terms of pituitary disease where you started at one place and you ended up at another place that really made a difference?
There's three. And, you know, the first one I'll tell you about is normally wouldn't be my patient. You know, I pretty much, I've done a rotation in pediatric endocrinology. I'm certainly not a pediatrician, and I don't, as a rule, treat kids. It's a, you know, pretty hard and fixed rule. I see adults. That said, I remember when I was in Columbus, there was this 12-year-old girl. And she had a tumor that was pretty large, and she had a fairly high prolactin level. It wasn't totally clear that the prolactin was coming from the tumor, because when you get, what I didn't mention, it was a little advanced for the audience, is that when a non-functioning tumor gets big enough and it cuts off that dopamine supply, remember it inhibits prolactin, prolactin can go up to about 150 or 200. So first of all, the pituitary tumor, the way it manifested in this girl was very rare, but I knew that as best I could tell in the situation as I remember it, I was going to be the expert. And I knew all of the potential complications of surgery, the blindness, the stroke, the infertility. And I thought to myself, most people think this is not prolactinoma. I definitely think it's worth a trial of dopamine agonist before we go in. You know, of course, the risk was you try it for 6 months and the tumor grows, and it's harder to take out if you're wrong. But fortunately, I was right, and we shrunk the tumor, and I will for always and ever remember the fact that I saved this girl a surgery that may have resulted in infertility and may have affected her life in a very, very big way going forward. Mm-hmm. So that's number one.
That's a great story to hear, an adolescent story that ends up having a very positive outcome for the rest of her life.
Yeah, no, that one sticks with me. The other one was very, I'm laughing at them because, you know, first of all, they're success stories, so they make me smile. But the second one was a woman, and she was so, so sweet. She had acromegaly, and they just couldn't cure it with surgery, and we had her go to some very, very fine surgeons. And again, that's not uncommon. It was a large tumor. And she unexpectedly got pregnant. So we're like, oh, boy. So the decision had to be made, you know, do you keep her on her medication or do you keep her off her medication? Mm-hmm. And we had a little bit of data over time, and I made the call. I said, you know what? And we talked it out, obviously had lots of heart-to-hearts about this. And she wanted to go through with the pregnancy. I said, well, I'll tell you what, let's take you off the medication. Let's maybe follow it with an MRI, which you know, can be done safely in pregnancy, particularly without gadolinium. It doesn't give any radiation or anything like that. We followed it along, and fingers crossed, it didn't grow. She ended up with a healthy baby boy. And when she found out I was leaving Ohio State, she wrapped her arms around me and hugged me, cried.
Well, you can't get much better outcome than that. There's two for one.
I mean, that's really why I started the practice that I did, to be able to just give my whole self to patients. And I'll just give you one more quickie. It was actually a recent patient I had who had a prolactinoma. And it was, it was sort of right about a centimeter or so, maybe a little less. And so, no-brainer, treat it with dopamine agonist. He had seen a different endocrinologist who treated him with cabergolin, to which he went home and had a weekend full of horrible headaches, okay? And when he went back to the endocrinologist, and according to the patient, the endocrinologist said, that can't be the dopamine agonist. So he actually came to me, and I said, well, of course it could. You're a smart guy. I mean, you know, you took it. You had the headaches. I mean, you know, that said, let's try a different one. Because he and his wife were really oriented to going to surgery. I said, look, I've never seen a horror outcome with a dopamine agonist. I've seen a horror outcome with surgery. So I gave him bromocriptine. Sure enough, I get a text at 2:46 a.m. A day or two later from his wife. I give her a call. Oh, Dr. Pinzone, he's got two pillows over his head because he's yelling. He doesn't want to wake the kids. And I said, there's your answer. Now we know you need surgery. We wouldn't normally do surgery for the microadenoma, but if something goes wrong, we're sure about it. He had it. Everything went great. It changed his life. And so even though it seemed inefficient, I said to him, the first thing that you would have asked me if that surgery went wrong is, why didn't you have me try it?
Right. So you got a clear answer. Very good.
It's one of those things where it's really the art of just listening to the patient and understanding the context of the specialist.
Very good. Well, those are all three great stories with very interesting outcomes and an appropriate treatment plan for sure. Well, we're at the end of the hour, actually. Time has flown by. We've taken about 45 minutes, and I do want our listeners to know how to reach your practice and you. So why don't you share that with them?
I will indeed do that. Before I do that, let me just give three resources. One of them is www.pituitarysociety.org. The other one is www.endocrine.org. And the last one is www.clinicaltrials.gov. I want people to know about that because they are trusted sources for getting to the right doctor.
Very
and
good.
Understanding if there's a clinical
and
trial.
And we'll put those
there.
Up on the radio website, too. So any of you listeners out there that didn't write it down, you can just dial in when you get back to the Internet and your computer, and we'll have them up there.
Right. And I wanted to take care of that business first before I talked about my practice. But thank you for asking. There's three ways that patients can there's three things I want to talk about very, very briefly. It'll take us under a minute. One of which is, so how do you access us? Well, it's simple enough. Just go on our website, www.medami.com. That's M as in Mary, E-D, med, one word, Amai, A-M-A-I, medami.com. And there's information on there on how to schedule an appointment. The other way you can do it is you can look me up on ZocDoc. That's www.zocdoc, Z as in zebra, Z-O-C-D-O-C, ZocDoc.com. Joseph Pinzone, endocrinologist, Santa Monica, and you can look at the reviews there, too, and make an appointment. So there's those two ways to get a hold of me. My address is 2001 Santa Monica Boulevard. I'm in the heart of Santa Monica with a beautiful view of the ocean on the 11th floor. So that's how to get in touch with me. The other two things I wanted to mention to your audience.
And your phone? Did we say your phone number?
The phone number. Yes, it's on the website, of course. But the phone number, you can call 855-MED-AMI, 855-MED-AMI. The other phone number that you can call if you're local is 310-453-2624.
Thank you.
So either of those are just fine, and that will get you directly to my office. Thank you for reminding me to say that part of the contact information.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you for being... Oh, you had one more thing.
I did. I had two more things real quick. One of them is my team and I are going to be featured on the American Heart Journal, which is a PBS series. And we don't have a firm air date, but that's going to happen this year, probably within 30 or 45 days is our best guess. And for an update on that, you can visit my either MedAMI site or my personal site is www.josephpinzone.com. And I will add one last thing, which is I have a book coming out on how to be a more powerful patient. This particular book is focused on patients with cancer because I felt like it offered a framework to give really cogent advice and very, very tangible steps. The book is called Fireballs in My Eucharist.
Wow.
It has its own patient story to it. but it's a very nuts and bolts book, a behind-the-scenes book about what your doctor wants to know about you. How you have the power. Don't give it away. Here's how to get the most out of our medical system if you have cancer. And you can pre-order that book on josephpinzone.com. It will be available on Amazon sometime in October.
Very good. So we did speak about that, and thanks for reminding me. Just for your audience out there, we plan on having Dr. Pinzone back near the end of the year to discuss that book in particular and how to be a better healthcare advocate for yourself through the system. I know at the end of the year, people are also taking a look at their health, renewing their benefits, thinking about a new commitment to their health. So we'll have you back in December and look forward to that. And good luck with the publishing of your book. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really enjoyed it. And I really hope that this helps some of the folks out there and that people enjoy it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. And for your listeners, thanks for tuning in to us today. We had a great visit with one of our national experts on pituitary diseases. We'll look forward to having him back. And please check with our sponsor site, www.healthgate.com, to see what resources there are for you, too. Thanks so much and have a great afternoon.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.